Call the meeting to order. Welcome everyone this morning. And we'll have the, I think we need to grant we need a motion and second to grant a leave of absence to Commissioners Alexander and Cooper Comas, who are out of town.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. Thank you. Also, one note, consent item number three, the Hillsborough Enterprise Zone has been taken off the agenda for today. It'll come up at a later meeting. Need a motion and second to approve the minutes of the regular commission meeting of March 8, 2017.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oops.
Oh, Pat's on the telephone. I'm sorry, Pat. I didn't realize you were on the telephone. We'll have the executive director's report from Bill now.
Great. Thank you very much. I see a lot of familiar faces, but I'll just kind of give my normal admonition, which is the executive director's report is actually a formal document that is submitted to the Port Commission along with their normal monthly meeting packet, and then I take advantage of this opportunity just to talk briefly about things that have gone on in the prior month here at the port. First, I'd just like to make note of the fact that we're live streaming the commission meeting. This is something we've done for several months, and it's been very successful so far and a lot less expensive than all of the alternatives. And you can see on the screen behind me and above here the port's monthly safety champions. Over the course of the last several years, really, we've been highlighting the importance of creating a really strong safety culture here, and it's really beginning to show, which is terrific. Also, as a reminder, on the back table, you'll find an evacuation map in the event something occurs during the course of this meeting. In the event of an emergency, port staff will escort everyone out the room, through the doors, down the hall to stairwell one, and out to the gathering area next to the north parking lot, which is across the road from the central utility plant. And I'd like to call on Stan Waters right now for this month's safety message.
Thanks, Bill. In recent months, we've been engaged in increasing construction activity around the terminal and the And you probably noticed on Airport Way this morning when you were coming in. We're currently undergoing major capital improvement projects that include the construction of the QTA area and the expansion of Concourse E. And these two projects do pose significant logistical safety challenges as they're occurring in active areas. It could pose potential hazards to both members of the public as well as employees out here at the airport. In order to minimize these risks, many controls have been put in place to prevent exposures. Some of these controls, however, will create roadway impacts and changes in normal traffic patterns. And our goal will be to limit the effects on the traveling public, but most importantly, keeping everyone safe on our roadways and throughout our operational areas. So today's message, I thought I would provide some key awareness tips on driving safely through these work zones and to inform people to have a heightened awareness when they're traveling to and from PDX. So safety tips, stay alert and give full attention to the roadway for both drivers and pedestrians. Pay close attention to signs and work zone flaggers. Turn on headlights so workers and other drivers can see your vehicle. Do not tailgate, leave plenty of room in case of sudden stops. Do not speed, slow down, and adhere to the posted speed limits. Keep up with traffic flow. Do not change lanes in the work zones. Minimize distractions in vehicles, so don't be changing your radios or using your cell phones. And I always say expect the unexpected when you're in these zones. Keep an eye out for all workers and their equipment. And be patient. And remember, I know these work zones aren't popular, but they are necessary as we make improvements to PDX, and work zone controls are necessary to keep us all safe. So that's my message for this month, Bill.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. So our next PDX Community Advisory Committee meeting is on April 19th. The PDX Community Advisory Committee is an outgrowth of the master planning process that the port went through several years ago. And speaking of this committee, we're very honored that our team took home this year's Star Award for Citizen Involvement from the Land Conservation Development Commission, presented for our excellence in creating and leading the PDX Community Advisory Committee. Last week, Alaska Airlines announced nonstop service to Detroit starting August 30th and JFK starting November 6th. And with this new service, Alaska and Virgin America will provide, which is now a subsidiary of Alaska, will provide Portland residents access to 130 daily nonstop flights to 58 destinations. And I might add that we were just told as well that they will begin service to Dallas Love Field, that is Alaska, in August. That means that Alaska will have added 8 new markets in 2017 so far. And I would expect that to continue because they're introducing the Embraer 175 to gradually take over for the Q400. And it just opens up so many new markets across the country. So we're obviously very pleased about that. The PDX team also received honors from Airport Revenue News Best Management Team, Best Overall Program, and Stumptown Coffee took home the prize for Best Chef-Driven Local or Regional Restaurant, as run by Latrell's Management, which also took home Best Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Operator honors. Green plates at the airport. PDX continues its green airport leadership with a new environmental pilot at PDX, providing real dishes and silverware to those who dine at food carts in the Oregon market. Plus, for our HQ employees, reusable to-go containers that are washed and returned to the concessions. The PDX bike path and parking changes ahead in preparation for the start of Concourse E extension construction project out that way. Changes to the routing of the bike path leading to the terminal will take place this month. That's a big challenge. There's very little room between the roadway and the airfield itself, so we'll have to reconfigure that until the construction is complete. In the marine world, you'll hear more in this meeting about the cargo market and actually, more importantly, the carrier market, one of the major presentations that will be made today. The final meeting of Governor Brown's transportation logistics meeting will be held on April 28th with 4 partner agencies, ODA, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, ODOT, Business Oregon, and the Port. This has really been a terrific forum to talk about logistics for particularly Oregon agricultural exporters. We have hired Ken O'Halloran, who I don't see in the room, but who's out working already as our marine marketing director. Ken has had a long, very distinguished career here on the Columbia River. He was executive director of the Port of Longview and the Port of Los Angeles, and brings more than 25 years of experience in the maritime industry to this role. We're really pleased to have him with us. My last of the statewide visits that we began a little over a year ago will occur at Hillsborough April 18th. This one we had to postpone during the January or the February commission meeting because of the snowmageddon. But it's timely because obviously we're also planning this will be our second meeting in the advisory committee for the Hillsborough Airport Master Plan, which occurs on May 4th. And the meeting will be held at Hillsborough Civic Center at 5:30 p.m. And that concludes my remarks.
Any comments? Motion and second to adopt the executive director's report.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Next, I would like to bring people current on the executive director search. Just a brief comment that we have released through the media announcements of what I'm going to cover here, basically. I first want to say thank you to those of you who are on the advisory group, which has been referenced in our earlier comments, a group of 8 people, 4 of those commissioners, Commissioners McDonald, Ceruta, Levy, and Alexander, who did a terrific job and took extra time to sort through resumes and interviews and make recommendation. And then for community folks, Andrew Colas of Colas Construction, Catherine Lamb of Bamboozy Restaurant, who operates here in the airport as well, Andrea Durbin, who is the head of the Oregon Economic or Oregon Environmental Council, and John Molas, who just retired as the head of the building trades, who's been very active in the port over the years. Those folks on a totally volunteer basis, both for their broad community engagement and leadership experience, were a great asset to the advisory group in making its recommendation. Its recommendation was that we have three finalist candidates. One is Jonathan Daniels, who is the current executive director and CEO of the Mississippi State Port Authority. Second is Stephanie Dawson, chief operations officer of the Port Authorities of New York and New Jersey. And Curtis Robin Holt, who is the, as you know, deputy executive director for the Port of Portland. Next on that schedule, what's actually occurring right now is a public comment period. We have a website. We use this earlier in the process. It is open. It opened on Monday the 10th this week, and we go stay open for 14 days through the 24th of April. We will then have an executive session, interviews of the three finalists before the entire commission on May 10th, the afternoon after our regular board meeting that morning. And then the commission will make an announcement publicly on the 23rd of May, a specially called notice meeting. And the public, again, will be invited to make comment at that meeting before the final decision is announced. I think the process has clearly benefited from the engagement of the four public members, as well as the commissioners on the advisory group. I want to say thank you also to Bobby Stedman, our director of HR, who has been actively pursuing this process with me, and Commissioner Pat McDonald, who is the chair of the advisory group, and for her leadership in that process. And we are headed toward an announcement, as I said, of our decision on the 23rd of May. So that's our timeline. I do know that we have had one person sign up to make comment this morning and on this topic, and so I'd ask Bob Salinger to come forward and make his comments at this time, and we'll take any other public input of those who wish to make comments today at this time. So, Bob. You can, Bob, why don't you come right up here to the front? Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Bob Salinger, and I'm representing the Audubon Society of Portland this morning. I appreciate the opportunity to comment. I'll be brief. My comments are a little more general than just the executive director search, but I'll be brief. First, while I do appreciate the opportunity to comment, I do continue to encourage you to have a general comment period at these sessions. I know other people were considering coming today, too, as well, but not having a set time on the agenda, I think, makes it tough for folks. For a group like Audubon, we have the capacity to show up and sort of figure it out. But for other groups, I think it's more difficult. So I think in the name of fostering more public engagement and involvement, it would be helpful to have a set agenda item where public comment, general public comment is allowed. I am primarily here to talk about the executive director search. I appreciate the committee that you all put together. But as has been reported in the media and elsewhere, we are disappointed that there's not going to be an opportunity for the public to meet with all three candidates, hear from them, ask them questions, and get to know them directly as part of the process for the public weighing in. I don't think it's realistic to expect that the public is going to be able to go out and do their own research on these folks and their own outreach and really get the kind of grounding they would need to make truly informed comments. And The information that was provided by the port to the public was pretty cursory. It certainly did not answer many of the issues that we're concerned about at Portland Audubon. And so I'm here today to encourage you to consider adding that to the mix. And I think it's important for a public agency to do that, especially one that has such a profound impact on the economy, the community, and the environment. Since that isn't on the docket, we actually this morning reached out to the candidates directly, all three of them, Willamette Riverkeeper and Portland Audubon, and requested interviews with each one. And we've already heard back from one almost immediately, so that was a good sign to us. But hopefully in this process or in future processes, I think it's important for public agencies to make sure the public really has a chance to interact, ask questions, learn about them, and weigh in the most meaningful way possible. Last thing I just wanted to mention this morning is there was a meeting a couple weeks ago with the City of Portland, the State of Oregon, and various community groups around Superfund. We were pleased that the Port of Portland participated in that. We thought that was a good sign. I think we're moving into a new era in Superfund. We've obviously had some very strong differences in the past with the Port over Superfund. But with the final record decision, we're moving into a new era, and we were pleased to see the Port of Portland at that meeting. I think as a public agency, it's really important that we start to, in this phase, build a lot more communication, collaboration, and understanding between the different interests. The last phase, prior to the record of decision, doesn't facilitate that. It's a pretty closed process, but now we have an opportunity to open it up, so I appreciate your all being there. Thank you.
Thank you. And just before you leave, just to respond to a couple of comments, I appreciate your comments. The process that we're following, we're not inconsistent with any other state agency in terms of what we're doing when we're in executive session and the opportunities we create for the public to make comment. In fact, we've gone further than some have by having these periods of comment, which as it worked on the first go-round, those comments are incorporated into questions by the people who are questioning the candidates at the time, whether that's the advisory group or whether that would be the commission when they ask the questions. We are representing the public in its entirety on this commission, and we do feel a responsibility to ask questions from all the different stakeholders as they arise, and that's part of the reason why we included different stakeholders or groups of stakeholders, community leaders in the advisory group itself, the outside people. I think it is and has been a healthy process. Appreciate your comments, and certainly anyone else who wishes to come here and speak, as I've said to you before, is welcome to do that. So thanks for the comments, and we will continue to hopefully end up with a process that gives us great lead on that person selected.
Thank you.
So we'll continue on here with the general discussion item, which is you, Vince, on the PDX workplace initiative update. This was discussed a bit the last meeting, and appreciate you and Chris coming back to give us an update today.
Sure, thanks very much. I'm here with Chris Sarnecki, he's our director of PDX Terminal Business and Properties, and he and his team are really responsible for the implementation of this program. We've been at this for a little bit now. Back in April of 2015, you all approved some general guiding principles on this program. And in a nutshell, what the program is really designed to do is to make sure PDX remains a great place for everybody. We have great employers here. We want to make sure it works for employees. And ultimately, that translates into a passenger experience. And that, to me, is kind of what we're all driving to, is that passenger experience. A lot of the focus here is on airport concessions and then airline subcontractors as well. So not necessarily port employees, but or direct airline employees either. But it's really just ensuring that PDX remains a great place. One. You know, the question is why do we do this? And as we've talked many times about PDX and being an award-winning airport, and it really is the standard that's been set here. And there's a number of different awards that are up here, and I just highlight a couple of them. Obviously, the J.D. Power 2 years in a row, the Travel and Leisure 4 years in a row. We recently got the Airport Revenue News, which is the trade industry for the concessions program across the country for airports. It was the best overall concessions program and management team last year. and the same thing with an Airports Council International. And the purpose of that program, and Chris will get into more of the details here, is really because there are 11,000 people that work at the airport, and there's almost 2,000 of them that are in that concessions program, and they have the opportunity every single day to impact the passenger experience through their contact and their approach with all of the customers. And so we know that if employees are not happy, they're not going to be able to provide the great service that happens here all the time and every single day. And we have a customer service recognition program. And this, I don't need to worry about all the names, but we just went through this. All of these folks on here are recognized and rewarded and acknowledged for the great service that they provide every single day to the passenger. And that's what translates into the great service that we have at PDX. It's what keeps us at the top. And so we want to make sure what we're doing through this workplace initiative helps the employees and generates more activity and for the businesses here, and ideally makes this a place that people want to work at. And that's really the purpose of this. We think at the end of the day, what we've been doing here, we are in a better place today than we were 2 years ago, but we still have much to learn as we go forward. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris and talk a little bit more about the details of the concessions program, some of the things we've got coming up next.
Sure. Thank you, Vince. Good morning. I wanted to focus a little bit today primarily on the concession program because we have some change that's happening there, and I wanted to make sure that that we went into the detail in focusing on the concession program, although the Workplace Initiative does have elements that apply to airline service providers, those contractors that do work for airlines. But why is the concession program important? I think it's an important aspect of why PDX is so successful. And you know, all these accolades don't happen by accident. And the concession program is consistently named as a primary element of why people love PDX so much. The revenue that we generate within the airport helps offset the costs for airlines and keep those manageable. And what that means for PDX is the opportunity for increased air service. And we've heard a lot about those announcements here recently. But it also creates a lot of business opportunity for small guys and the big guys. And we think that's a unique aspect of what PDX does. Now, PDX has been doing this for a long time, has kind of set the standard in the airport industry for terminal concessions. And we think that we're taking it to the next level, and I think other airports in the industry are trying to follow in our footsteps. So I also want to point out that it is an extension of the community. And people's impression of Portland and of the region are really first made when they arrive here in Portland. And a lot of times that's getting a cup of coffee or sitting down at a restaurant in the terminal. So these employees are very important for many reasons to us. And that's why we pay a lot of attention to it. What makes PDX concession program unique? We have a direct leasing approach here. Many airports, they give large portions of the program to one prime concessionaire. We don't do that here. We award individual contracts. We do package some things together and coffee and news and gift. But primarily that helps us get a lot of variety and give that opportunity for smaller businesses to enter the market. We have always focused on local and regional brands. We have some national brands too, because that's what customers want. But we try to focus on the brands that are here that are a reflection of our community. We have a true street pricing model, and this is one of the fundamental values of our concession program. And one of the things that really drives the success within the program, people know that they're getting the price here at PDX that they get on the street, and they're more likely to spend their time, arrive a little early, and spend time with our concessionaires. We think that's very important. We also have a lot of direct involvement. Our staff spends a lot of time directly with these operators to ensure their success. So right now we have a lot going on in the concession program. We've been here over the last few years with a couple of RFPs. We have a new one, the 2017 RFP, that's on the street right now. And over the last few years, we've awarded 21 leases. These leases have 7-year and 10-year terms. So they are long-term agreements with these operators that allows them stability and the ability to amortize their significant investment in these spaces. It's considerably expensive to build out here at PDX, and we want to make sure they have the term to recoup that investment. But it also creates stability. At the same time, we want to refresh the program, bring in new brands, and try to adapt to growth in the market as well as bringing in new brands that help drive business. So this RFP that we have out right now has four locations in it. Three are currently expiring contracts. These contracts expire on January 31st, 2018. Laurelwood, that's operated by SSP America. Rogan Roses is operated by HMS Host. And InMotion, which is a retail unit on Concourse D. So we are rebidding those locations in a like-for-like swap. We are also adding one location to Concourse C West out here that will grow the program. This is a space that is currently vacant. So let me talk a little bit about the workplace initiative. And these are the issues that we tried to address broadly within the initiative. Benefits, employee retention, and job pathways are specifically addressed in the workplace initiative. Wages was a topic that was we had a lot of discussion about, but we chose to address this more indirectly and preferred that this was addressed on a broader level, and that's exactly what happened when the state implemented their minimum wage back in 2015. So a little more specifically on the RFP requirements, we, back with the 2016 RFP, we implemented something new here called the PDX Quality Employer Plan. And I'll draw your attention to this line here, referred to as Exhibit K within the RFP. This receives the highest weighting of all the criteria within our process. And certainly we are very focused on having good brands here, great design. There are ACDPE requirements that are federally mandated. And all of these scores play an important part. But we chose to make the weighting of this employer plan the highest because of the value that it provides for all the reasons that we've just talked about. We think good employers mean happy employees and a good customer experience. So specifically within that, we ask for information in these five categories. And what we're doing differently in this RFP is we're getting a little more specific. In the 2016 RFP, we left this a little more broad and we asked employers to give us their plan in these, generally in these five categories. This time we have an 8-page questionnaire that will have a lot of specifics within it on wages, benefits, what kind of equity programs they have, safety, training and advancement. And this will allow us to really get an apples to apples comparison on the proposals that we receive in the coming months. So I want to say too that we modeled this a little bit after we developed this to try and get a little more granular with the information, but we took this based on what Seattle has been doing and modified that with some input from external stakeholders, including Unite Here.
So Chris, if I might ask a question on this specific, if you go back one slide here.
Okay.
Yeah. So our opportunity to have real impact is through the employers themselves of the concessions, correct?
Yes.
I mean, so when we add provisions like this in their application to lease, and whatever we add into that lease is really the enforcement mechanism that we have as opposed to directly with the employees of those concessions.
Correct. Our contracts are with the employers. This exhibit that is submitted as part of the proposal becomes a part of their contract.
Right.
The exhibit is actually attached to their lease agreement, and so that's the enforcement mechanism.
Okay. And you will address that plan for enforcement later in your conversation here?
Yeah, I'd be happy to address it now, too, and a couple points on that and how we enforce this. I want to say that it becomes a part of the contract. So just like all other provisions within the contract, we monitor our concessionaires for lease compliance in a number of ways. If we receive complaints about any of these issues that are addressed in this exhibit or on food quality or staffing or hours, just like any other lease provision. We would work with the employer, investigate that, and determine if they're in compliance with their lease. If they're not in compliance with their lease, we take action based upon that, leading up to and including termination for egregious prolonged violations. We also have an audit program here where we report auditors every year. We'll select certain concessionaires for audit. Because this is part of the contract, this would be an element of their audit.
Thanks.
So we also implemented the TriMet Pass program. This is a program where the port provides a 25% offset to a monthly pass on TriMet. This came out of our focus groups with employees and employers who talked about the difficulties in getting to the airport for employees. That creates challenges in recruitment and retention. So we tried to offset the cost and help out. We hope that employers take advantage of this and split the cost again further with the employees. So we've seen some growth in this. We have currently 10 companies that are enrolled, and hope that as the summer months come, there's greater participation from our concessionaires. This is also, the TriMet Pass program is also open to airline service providers. When it comes to employee retention, our goal is to offer an opportunity for every employee who wants to stay here at PDX to stay at PDX. And this becomes challenging in these transitions when there's construction happening, there's closures and reopenings. So we created a labor pool that is a tool that employees and employers can use to create these connections to new incoming concessionaires. We had our first experience with this in 2016. The expiring contracts displaced more than the 74 employees you see here. HMS Host and their Starbucks operation did not have any employees enter the labor pool. They actually retained all of those employees. But here you can see the numbers on the participation. And out of the 74, we just made payouts to 16 of those employees who were retained for 6 months within PDX. So I think the other point I want to make here too is that our port staff worked very directly, name by name, with all the employers on the labor pool, and took a considerable amount of personal interest in trying to create those connections, because we realize that can be difficult. We also established the jobs at PDX.
One second, Chris.
Oh, sorry.
I was going to wait until you were done, but I think this might be a good juncture to ask my question. First of all, I think this is far superior to the product brought forward in 2016, so I appreciate all your work, and actually you addressed many of my concerns and concerns I heard from Unite Here and other folks. But my question is this. Part of this is a complaint-driven accountability process, right? So is how would I'm an employee for a concessionaire? How would do that? Would I know that there is a complaint process?
I think we are. I'll say it this way: our employees, our staff, our concession operations team, as well as our customer relations team, spend a lot of time in the terminal with employees directly, as well as employers. And there's a good connection between port staff and employees that work at PDX. And if there are things going on in the terminal that we hear complaints all the time, we don't hear a lot about employers, but we do hear, we get a lot of questions through those channels. So I think there is that connection, that opportunity.
Yeah, but it may be there might be a better way to create an open forum for folks to be able to call. So we can take a look at some opportunity there.
I think that would be really great. I mean, you have a great website, and to have sort of the process on the website so an employee at least could see it and see how they go about filing a complaint would be worthwhile.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, we'll do that. Good. So you see the numbers here on the jobs board, and this was created back in June of 2015, and the participation has grown And, you know, I looked this morning, we're down to 101 jobs, so hopefully a few of those 124 got filled. And if you look at the employers who are participating in this, it represents broadly, just across the board, all of the types of businesses that operate here at PDX. So there's a lot of opportunity to move between employers, but also to change the types of employer that you're working for. So I'll just wrap up with a timeline on the concessions RFP. The proposals are due in May this year, and our intent is to bring a recommendation for award in August of 2017. Those locations will close January 31st, 2018. There'll be a construction period, and then they'll reopen within 3 to 4 months afterwards. So that's our timeline. And with that, I'll take any other questions.
Any questions? Thanks very much.
Great.
That's very helpful, and we'll ask you back again at least by next year.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks. Keith, you're going to do an update here on the container market.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And we'll just click to the next slide, just a reminder here.
Good morning, Randy.
So a month ago, we were here to essentially enter into an agreement to get the leasehold back from ICTSI, and if I can grab the arrow here. Just a reminder, I really like this slide that our public affairs department just created. So T6 is really a 420-acre multi-use complex. You've got Honda on the upriver side of the container facility. You've got AWC, who handle the planned imports, the Ford exports, on the downstream side of T6. Within the 192-acre footprint that just reverted back to us as a result of terminating the lease with ICTSI is also a group of uses that goes on within that footprint. What we're planning, just as a reminder, is to use Berth 603 as a multi-use general cargo facility, very consistent with the way that it has been used historically. It's really not going to be in the study that we look at in defining our future niche in the container business. We're going to be out looking for business immediately for that. Like as in right now, we will take our time, and you'll see kind of why we need to take our time when you hear from the state of the container carrier industry from Randy. And we will study what our future niche is with Berth 604 and 605 around the ocean container business. What does that look like in the future? We're pretty sure it's not going to look a lot like what it used to look like in the past, and there's some real fundamental changes going on there. We've got the intermodal facility. This is essentially an unutilized, rarely been utilized facility that we would love to find a way to activate on behalf of our shipper market. And then the rest here are the warehouses and the office facilities. It'll be worth going out there at some point, taking another trip through to see all of the equipment that reverted back to us, over 190 pieces of equipment from ICTSI. Everything went orderly. Everything looks good out there. It's certainly dated as a facility, but we have all the infrastructure and the equipment necessary to stand up a future operation, and then the financial close happened as well at the end of the month. So this is what we're looking at going forward. We will, obviously, the lease came back to us on March 31st. We're in the market right now for consulting assistance focused on this study of what is our future niche in the container business. We have a concept around an industry leader committee that we'd like to bounce a lot of these concepts by, get guidance from throughout the process. The process would essentially begin in the May-June timeframe for the study and then culminate at the end of the calendar year with check-in points with you all along the way. We haven't quite baked that part in. You can think of Randy's presentation as a step in that direction. Fairly regular updates with the commission certainly in task force, but even in general discussion, to be able to have a public dialogue around what the business looks like. So today is really a first step. We're going to focus in on the carrier industry itself. We're going to come back to you, maybe not next month, but I think in June, to talk about the shipper market, the cargo market. And so that's what you're not going to hear today. You'll hear more about what's happening with the global container industry. Randy is our resident expert, Randy Fisher, our marine, he works in our marine research department, has been a key tool and asset for us for many years on all the market analysis that we do. So with that,
here we go.
Take it away.
All right. Good morning. I'm going to provide an update today on the state of the container industry, what's going on. I'm going to get a little in the weeds in some things, and so I just wanted to put it out right now. If there's anything that you have any questions, please just stop me, ask me. I want to make sure that we can stay on the same page. Is it? Oh, there goes half my presentation. Fair enough. I'll just start with a quick, I'm going to use the term TEU, which is 20-foot equivalent unit many times. So I'll just say that TEU is a 20-foot container, and most commonly is used in shipping is 40-foot containers, which is equivalent to 2 TEU. So you have a 6,000 TEU ship that can handle 3,000 40-foot containers. Couple of main trends I'm going to run through today. The key thing is really there's been an arms race going on. There's been an arms race going on for many, many years within the carrier industry, as essentially the world market is controlled by 20 companies. And these 20 companies have been in this race for market share to see who can get the most market share, who can grow it. And one of the key ways they've been doing this is by building bigger and bigger ships. They have been doing this at a pace that has far outpaced the growth of consumption, the growth of desire, demand to ship containers on these ever bigger container ships. Well, you can't deny the slot economics. It does get cheaper. The bigger the ship gets, it does get slightly cheaper to ship it on that ship. It does not make up for the massive losses that carriers have been taking. As a result of this, we have been seeing a reduction in the, a lot of consolidation has been going on in the market. And these are companies that are well over 100 years old that have been going away all just in the last 18 months. And I'll touch on that, and what that, how that's going to impact the market as well. Finally, I think this picture is a great example of what we see in the market. That ship there in the middle, the Benjamin Franklin, is an 18,000 TEU ship. That is the largest ship to ever call the U.S. West Coast, which came last summer. Those kind of ships, this building has driven not only the carrier industry, but all of these sort of cascading impacts. We are seeing the Port of New York, New Jersey has invested $1.3 billion in raising the Bayonne Bridge, literally just raising it so that these ships can fit under the bridge. Over $1 billion being invested on the East Coast, so ports like Charleston and Savannah can deepen their channels so that these ships can get in. And over $5 billion invested in the Panama Canal, which was planned years ago. And by the time the Panama Canal opened in the summer, it can fit a maximum of about 11 to 12,000 TEU vessels. That's an 18. We've already surpassed that, what the Panama Canal has designed. The last piece I would say, if you can see it, it's kind of hidden in the far corner on the right. That is the C-SPAN Hamburg. That is a vessel that is 4,250 TEUs in size, or not that far off from the maximum that the Port of Portland can currently handle. We can go up to about 6,500. Compare that against the Benjamin Franklin at 18,000 TEUs. Not only is our river not deep enough, our cranes aren't tall enough, and our cranes couldn't even reach all the way out to grab the furthest away containers. So that there's a number of different things that are, picture that farthest on the right, that's about the size ship. That up to about 4,000 to 6,000 TEU is what we're looking for. That's ideal for us, given our present state. This next slide, it's a graphic from the Financial Times. It's very simple, but I think it tells a huge story If you look at the blue bars, that shows you the demand, the growth of interest. We have a relatively healthy global economy. We've seen positive percentage growth for the past 4 years, as well as forecasted in 2017. But if you contrast that to the green bar, which is the growth in capacity of ships capable of handling goods back and forth, you can see every single year it continues to grow above it. So what happens when this occurs, you're essentially supply is growing much faster than the demand for it. It forces prices down. And that's exactly what's happened. There's been a couple of things that the carrier industry has done to combat this. They have done something called slow steaming. They will slow the vessels down purposefully. One, it saves fuel, but two, it requires more assets. They have to put more ships into that rotation of, let's say, 10 ships going back and forth between Seattle and Shanghai. Now they have to put 11 or 12 ships in order to maintain a weekly call that a ship shows up every single week. And so that's something that has helped to chew up assets. Two is idling, essentially mothballing these ships. Currently, the entire world global fleet, container fleet, 6% of all container ships is mothballed. Is idled right now, is not being used. This was very popular around 2009 and 10 during the economic recession, where we had, I believe, 11% of all ships were idled. This is a number that has been growing, where it's gone back down, and now we're slowly creeping back up to about 6% of ships are idled. The third and the more recent developing trend is the scrapping, just sending these container ships to the scrapping. If you look back over several years, you'll see a typical useful life of a container vessel is 30 years. And that has maintained, okay, the average age of these ships scrap 30. And you start getting back in the last 4 or 5 years, and you start seeing that age dropping. As of last year, the average age of a scrap vessel was 19 years old. And in fact, just in December of 2016, the newest container vessel ever was scrapped, a 4,250 TEU vessel purchased for $60 million in 2010. Was sold to scrap for $6 million. I'll give you an idea of what the market is trying to do to correct itself. Before I move on, I just want you to focus here on 2015, because I think that shows a great illustration of what the next slide I'm going to talk about and the difference between all the container vessels coming on the market versus the increase in demand. This next slide is... the Shanghai Shipping Exchange, they put together this price tracking called the Shanghai Container Freight Index. And they do this for different origin and destination points all over the world, but the one we follow is the Shanghai to U.S. West Coast. You can see over 6+ years the rate that somebody pays to get something from Shanghai to the U.S. West Coast. And they do this by surveying a number of different carriers, and they tend to keep at a base level. This specifically is L.A. and Long Beach, Shanghai to L.A. and Long Beach. And I will say it is spot rates. Another kind of rate would be a contract rate, which is typical for more like a Target or a larger shipper that will sign to say, we want to pay X amount for the entire year, and the next year we'll come back and renegotiate. A spot rate is based on basically driving down to the dock and saying, I've got a container and I need to get it to LA from Shanghai. How much is it going to cost? So we see a lot more volatility and movement in that. And you can see in 2009 where it had reached its absolute bottom with the economic recession and 11% of the ships being idled, that as demand started back up, it forced the rates back up. This brought a lot of ships back into the market. I want to make an important point here that when you order a container ship, it could be a 2 to 3 to 4 year process from pulling the trigger, we're going to drop, you know, X tens of hundreds of millions of dollars to buy a container ship before it actually comes out into the market. So it's a really long range trigger that you've got to pull. So if we see the rates going up, you picture people ordering container ships around 2010, 11, 12, feeling like this recovery is happening. Then in 2015, we see a lot of ships coming out of the market, and you see what happens to the rates is not only do they go down, they hold at a abnormally low level, below the lowest levels in 2009. There were reports mid-2016 of losses within the industry of $5 to $10 billion. There was speculation that many, multiple carriers would not survive. And it's hard because carriers, in many ways, can be their own worst enemy. It's carriers that are doing this by pulling the trigger and building too many ships, and they're having this arms race. And so we're seeing this happen. I will say that in 2000, coming in towards 2017 and beyond, we have seen some increase, improvement in the rates, which is great because, and I'll explain that a little later, that's why it is great for Portland. So it is good to see what we're seeing here. Another point I want to make here is about the eastbound versus westbound. Now, I say that this is an eastbound or an import. For this, I tend to think of furniture is to me a good example, because you think of a 40-foot container and how many big couches can you fit in? Let's say you can put 10 big couches in a 40-foot container, and you're going to pay $1,000 so to ship that container. So the added cost is $100 per couch is what you're paying to ship that product. Well, you see the volatility where we're seeing it closing in on $2,500. All of a sudden, you've got to pay $250 per couch that's moving. Now, so this is a good way to track what the added cost is to goods that are imported, which is consumer electronics, apparel, footwear, other products. We don't typically have anywhere near this kind of information on the exports. Hay, animal feed, agricultural products, scrap metal. Those aren't tracked as much because those are known as a backhaul or kind of the carriers looking, hoping to more break even. These products, the consumer electronics, the high-end stuff, this is what we call the head haul, or where they make their real money. The exports moving out, the carriers are at best a break even. Maybe they'll make a little money on refrigerated exports like frozen French fries. So this is more what the carriers watch, this is more what we watch in terms of the rates. For this slide and the next, I want to talk a little about capacity. Think of it this way, that for every, let's say, 10 5,000 TEU ships that you pull out of the market and replace with 10 10,000 TEU ships, you're essentially doubling the capacity to handle goods. And that's what this graphic, the total, if you took all the ships in the Far East and North America trade, you've got about 300 ships. Those 300 ships as of 2010 equals about 2 million TEUs of total capacity. These 300 ships represent 37 strings. I'll talk a little about strings and how this works for a second. I'm going to use an analogy of TriMet. You think about TriMet, and TriMet has routes that goes all over Portland. And there's bus 18 and bus 33. And they, in order to ensure that we're calling, that TriMet bus is stopping every 20 minutes at a bus stop, TriMet knows it has to put X number of buses into that string. Well, that's very much how these ships work in order to maintain every 7 days or a weekly service in order to hit these ports, LA, Seattle, Shanghai, Busan, we have to put in 8 ships. In order to do all of these port rotations, we have to put in a dozen ships. So you'll see between, let's say, 6 and 12 ships in each of these 37 strings, totaling 300 ships that make up the capacity here. I would say 2 points in time that I would want to illustrate. Oh, the other thing, it'd be the dotted line in there. That is a rough equation of what the Port of Portland can handle. We're up to around 6,500 TEU, so it's right somewhere in the middle of the red zone, and the pink area is all perfect for the Port of Portland. Pretty clear when you look at the graphic what's been happening is it's these 7,500 TEU and larger vessels have been taking over more and more.
And I would just add one other kind of insidious characteristic, too. These bigger ships, particularly when you get into the 10 and 13,000 TEU variety, have stability issues that don't apply to the smaller ships. So they actually have to have a certain volume of cargo to sail safely. So in order to get the cargo which they need to sail safely, they price it at whatever they need to in order to get the cargo, which further disadvantages vessels further down that color chart because they're obviously not able to compete in any event on a slot basis.
There were rumors. Well, there were reports coming out of under $100 to move a container from Europe to Asia, and it had to do more with ensuring that they had an adequate weight to move the ship. The thing is, with this compared to other regions, I would point out that two points in time. I do want to point out two points in time. 2011, February, we're signing over the terminal to ICTSI. If you look at that, you see a market where the market is about 2.5 million TEUs of total capacity, and of that, about two-thirds of the market can call Terminal 6. We fast forward to today, we get a terminal back. Looking at the global carrier market specific to the North American trade with Asia, we see that it's now grown to about 3 million TEUs, of which we can handle about 1 million total TEUs of the capacity, or one-third. So our ability to handle that has shrunk, but I will speak a little later about the Pacific Northwest, and it's not anywhere near as bad as this. We've seen some of that increase has been more in the increasing size of the Panama Canal, which has incorporated more larger vessels going into East Coast services, and the California ports tend to get more than large. So the Pacific Northwest is still looking much, much better in terms of capability. Lastly, I would say that the of the orange that has really become more common for North America, that is very different from other trades. We've got much smaller vessels, 1,000, 2,000 TEU vessels that are common for intra-Asia and intra-Europe. So think of it as just running ports in between smaller ports in Asia or within Europe to some larger ports like a hub and spoke. If you look at the Asia to Europe trade, it is almost now entirely made up of green and purple or vessels above 10,000 TEUs. Those are the largest ships in the world are typically engaged in that trade. Secondary would be the North American Asia trade. This particular slide, I really like it. It's every container vessel ever made.
It's very artistic.
It is. It's
artwork.
Yeah. Every dot represents a vessel. You could see by the year it was built and the size. The green and yellow back on the far left are basically essentially conversions, converting existing vessels into vessels that can handle container ships. So it's not until the late 60s that you start seeing actual vessels built as container ships. This goes along until the mid to late 90s as vessels are slowly. I will say in the late 90s, there wasn't a container vessel on the globe that could not come into Port of Portland. It really wasn't until you see this curve start happening close to 2000, and it almost becomes exponential when you look at it. And this is what I talk about, the arms race. I will say the red dots that are vessels that are on order. You can see this goes out to 2020 and what's going to be what we should expect to be seeing. And the big chunk of blue dots is more on the lower end, the 3,000, 2,000. That's more of the almost like a barge service, like smaller container vessels running in between ports. 2 weeks ago, so the picture I showed you, the very first picture of the 18,000 TEU ship, I will say it is not the biggest. 2 weeks ago, the largest container ship in the world was launched, the MOL Triumph. It is over 20,000 TEUs that it can handle. It will not hold that title for very long. Before the end of 2017, a 21,000 TEU ship will be launched into the world market. I will say, looking at this graphic, we're seeing that trend start to stop because you see the order book starts to dry up. So hopefully that will calm down. The last thing I want to point out here, if you look at this red circle, is almost seeing kind of a wedge happening between the vessels, the smaller vessels that are more the intra-Asia and intra-Europe trade versus the larger vessels. Not only those that have been launched in the past 4 or 5 years, but those that are planning to be built between around 4,000 to 8,000, seeing a gap occurring there in the market. This next slide, I want to talk a little about the consolidation that's been happening with carriers just really over the last 18 months. This, what we're looking at here, is over 90% of all containers shipped in the world. I originally wanted to do the graphic by showing them the countries that they're from, but being that 11 of the 20 are all in four countries, Japan, China, Taiwan, and Korea, I couldn't quite fit them. So I still put them over closer to the continents, but you'll see the clear thing here is that there isn't a single carrier in North or South America. They are all Asia or Europe-based. of these 20 carriers in just the last 18 months, I'm going to go back to December 2015, you see Costco and China Shipping, the two Chinese-based carriers, they went away and merged as Costco, Shipping. Following that, in June, started in 1976, the largest shipping company in the Middle East, the UASC, was acquired by Hapag-Lloyd. Then APL, over on the bottom left, started in 1848 as a service to bring supplies from New York to California and gold back to New York. Was acquired and sold to the French line CMACG. And it now no longer exists. December 2016, Hamburg Süd, one of the two German carriers, which started in 1871, offering service from Germany over to Brazil and Argentina, was acquired by Maersk Line, and it is now gone. And, of course, September, big one for us, Hanjin Shipping filed bankruptcy. I will say of that, there is one that is emerging. There's a new one coming into play right now. We don't know a whole lot about it, but it's called KLC, or Korean Lines, SMKLC, which is a Korean carrier emerging in many ways out of the ashes of Hanjin. And so we have high hopes there, as many of the employees are Hanjin. They all know Port of Portland. They have good relationships with them. So there is hope there with that new carrier. We've heard route announcements yet, but they haven't actually started. So they are acquiring vessels, so more to come on that. Finally, I will say that there are three Japanese lines up in the top left there, NYK, KLN, and NOL. Those three are in the process of merging. There's no name yet. It's in the industry, we call it the J3, the three Japanese carriers. So when those are merged, that will then go from 20 to 14 remaining carriers that control 90%+, over 90% of the world. Container shipping on the ocean. Another dramatic event that unfolded throughout 2016 was alliances. So these companies will form alliances to share space, much like booking a airline ticket on United and then showing up to see that it's an Air Canada plane. They will do the same thing. The top alliance there, Oceans Alliance, I could call CMA, Costco, Evergreen, or OOCL, and get four different rate quotes for what ends up being moving my container on the exact same ship from the exact same origin destination. Because they're all sharing space, they can have some pricing power, but you can go to each of their websites, and they may each have different names for the same exact service going back and forth. But they do that so that they can show that they have a much broader service network. These alliances on the plus side, if we're able to get in with one, that means we're going to get all the other services coming in as well. Much like the CKYH, which was Costco, now part of the Oceans Alliance, Yang Ming and K-Line, which are part of the Alliance, and Hanjin, no longer in existence. CKYH was an alliance that called here at the Port of Portland for years. Less than 10% of the vessels are now, 10% of the capacity to North America is now being served by non-alliance carriers, which is largely ZIM, and then the new KL, or Korean Alliance, represents the most of them. Bulk of that. What this means for the Pacific Northwest. We did see a reduction in the number of weekly calls. We did go from 13 to 12 weekly calls in the Pacific Northwest, a 5% reduction in our total capacity. There are 16 terminals. I'll talk about terminals on the next slide. Of those, we have 12 vessel calls. I will say most vessel calls will call at multiple terminals. You might call Vancouver, Prince Rupert, down to Seattle, and then back over to Asia. Because of the reduction of calls, because of the new alliances, we will likely see some consolidation on the terminals. We do expect some terminals will win, some will lose. But of that, we could see that there are 8 services that can still call Portland. So 2/3 of all services. So a much better look than the actual whole North American market. We do have more smaller vessels still coming into the Pacific Northwest. Of the terminals when I say the Pacific Northwest, I'm including Canada. There are 16 terminals. One of the 16 is Terminal 6. We've got 10 more in Seattle, Tacoma. four in Vancouver and one in Prince Rupert. Seattle and Tacoma for years had been in a feud, fighting. They're basically taking cargo from each other. Seattle would go undercut Tacoma to get their customers, and it would kind of go back and forth. Meanwhile, Vancouver and Prince Rupert were slowly gaining market share. They were taking that away. And what they're fighting over is what's called discretionary cargo, or cargo that can move through multiple different ports. It's primarily, think of Chicago, the U.S. Midwest, the northern tier. So that's what Vancouver, Prince Rupert, Seattle, Tacoma, all fighting to get a piece of that cargo. This is not uncommon. This occurs in between Los Angeles and Long Beach will fight each other, Charleston and Savannah, the Port of New York, and the other surrounding ports. But what Seattle and Tacoma did was pretty unprecedented. They decided to merge. So they merged their assets. They pulled together their container terminals into one they called the Northwest Seaport Alliance. They now have the North Harbor, Seattle, and the South Harbor, Tacoma, totaling the 10 container terminals. I will say that while I can't say that the alliance formation is a direct result of what's happened, I will say in the last year, for the first time in several years, the Seattle and Tacoma, the Northwest Seaport Alliance, their volumes went up while the ports of Vancouver and Prince Rupert went down. One point about Prince Rupert, many people don't know about this port. It's a new port. It opened, the newest port, it opened in 2008. In less than 10 years, it's gone from zero to 700,000 TEUs, or more than double our best year ever. It is a town of 13,000 people that enjoy hockey and curling. They have no cargo base there. It is all serving U.S. Midwest, northern tier Midwest. That is, so you can think about it as that they have captured the market that was previously controlled more by Seattle and Tacoma. Hopefully, this will help counteract that and allow them to better compete. And frankly, help us better too if we can get more services down in the Puget Sound area. Provides more assistance with what we're trying to do in terms of providing cargo access to our shippers. Last thing I want to point out here is if you look, well, this is not to scale exactly. I will say the largest terminal in the entire U.S. Pacific Northwest is Terminal 18 at 196 acres. The second largest terminal in the entire United States Pacific Northwest is our Terminal 6, is number two. Number three is Terminal 5, which is currently closed for construction or modernization efforts is what they're going under. If you look at the 3.6 million TEUs and divide it by the 9 active terminals through the Northwest Seaport Alliance, you have an average of 400,000 TEUs per year. Some will be more, some will be less. If you take the 5 years prior to ICTSI taking over the terminal and you average those, our Terminal 6, the second largest in the Pacific Northwest, handled 125,000 TEUs a year. Just food for thought. To conclude, what does this mean for Portland? Of the 12 services, there are 8 that are capable of calling Terminal 6. So those would be the ones that we will want to focus on. It is ideal to go after those that are in your backyard. Hence Seattle, Tacoma competing, Charleston, Savannah. It's about if carriers are calling into the Pacific Northwest, those are the ones that we're going to have the highest likelihood of attracting to pay swing on down. Two, while this is not necessarily a part of this presentation I've given, there are very strong market-driven reasons that we can support service to Asia, other areas such as Europe, Central and South America, and that's something that Keith had mentioned, and I look forward to returning back here again with a much more upbeat presentation about our market and what our capabilities, what will drive the demand for carriers to want to come here. Freight rates are going up. This is the reason I said this is good for Terminal 6, and I want to see freight rates going up, even though most shippers in the state will cry out, that is, no, we need rates low. The higher the rates go up, the more profit carriers make. The more profit carriers make, the more increased appetite they will have to take on risk, to add new ports, to come into niche markets. Hence, I want to see the rates go up. And then finally, more closer to home, is that we need to be addressing our labor and market concerns here prior to carriers being willing to return to Portland, which goes back to the study that Keith talked about. And with that, I will open it up for questions and a lovely picture of Terminal 6.
Looks empty. So questions, comments, Tom?
Thank you so much. A lot of work has gone into this, I can tell.
Thank you.
Yes. The trend behind all of which, the bigger, the more capacity, the better. That kind of trend that you have been looking at. In your professional, view, will it likely change, or i.e. revert back to a more sensible, economically, you know, workable size in terms of container ship in the near future, just like we have seen or witnessed that in the U.S. auto production industry, bigger SUV, this and that, down, including Humvee, you know, to a little more sensible size and, fuel economy, this and that. What is your view? It's maybe an academic question.
That's a good question, Commissioner. If we go back 15 years ago, we would say that the Airbus 380 would come out promoting that they were going to take over the market. It would all be Airbus 380. You'd take a little spoke flight to get on your Airbus 380 to go anywhere. And what's happened 15 years later is that hasn't happened. It was this fear that it would take over. There's still plenty of regional flights. People want to fly direct. With seeing the reduction in the ordering of vessels and the slowdown in the size, almost stopping of the increase of size, I have not. Typically, I'll hear things like, oh, the new designs are out for the 28,000 TEU ship. Or I haven't heard that. So I do think that that's slowing down. And I feel like we will see that wedge. While that wedge is likely going to continue, I don't know that I could see the vessels getting larger and larger. Eventually, we'll probably come to a situation where it's a more comfortable split between the smaller and the larger ships.
But, I think it's worth noting, I agree with what Randy had to say, but for the Columbia River, you know, in the long run, it's not a good trend because when you just start looking at the points on that one graph in particular about kind of where the river is headed, the vessels are just too big. And we also don't have the cargo base to support those larger vessels. You have two things going on there. And finally, we're export-oriented, and exports generate lower freight rates. So, you know, the Columbia River is headed for a niche, a type of container service. And the big ships are intended to serve big markets, you know, Shanghai to Rotterdam and Singapore to Mumbai and so on and so forth. And we just don't turn out to be that for the most part.
Go ahead.
Yeah, very, very good presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
But I did have a question. You said that the largest terminal was in Seattle, Terminal 18. Did you say they processed about 400,000 containers a year? And then Portland's Terminal 6 is the second largest. Mm-hmm. And before ICTSI, they averaged about 126,000 units?
125, yes. Yeah. It's basically, my math is saying 9 terminals total, 3.6 million TEUs handled by Northwest Seaport Alliance. The average is 400,000. The reality is Terminal 18 is much higher. Terminal 18, just looking at the terminals and knowing who is moving through what, I'd say Terminal 18 and Terminal 46 were probably two of the highest. And yes, they are. Terminal 18 is 4 acres larger than Terminal 6, which is the second largest, and our average at 125,000 TEUs. If we take the average over the last 4 or 5 years, it's much, much lower, obviously. But our best year ever was in 2003, and that was about 340,000 TEUs.
I'm just curious, what type of footprint would you need to accommodate, say, 130,000 units? Would it be 70 acres, 75 acres?
It's very absolutely feasible. Now, there's several different ways to increase your capacity in a terminal, all the way from a grounded or wheeled service, everything is sitting on flatbeds, to a stacked where you have RTGs, rail tiered gantry cranes that will roll over, and they can be 6, 7, 8. I mean, I'm certain Bill's probably seen terminals in Asia that are much, much higher, to a fully automated terminal where you don't have, let's just say that the I don't want to say the sky's the limit, but you can definitely do a lot more with less. And this is more common in Europe, where land is much more scarce than in America, where we seem to have a lot more land.
70 or 80 acres would be great. I mean, because we're not going to have a fully automated terminal. The investment that is required to do that is just far too great for the value and the volume of the cargo that we have. And so you need to account for that. So you won't have real mounted gantry cranes and you know, all those other goodies. But 75 or 80 acres would be great, which leaves you with a lot of terminal to do and contemplate other things, which is good.
So, yeah. So as you guys launch into this effort of gathering data and deciding what the right questions are and what the answers are, it's, to me, from the Commission's perspective, important to look at this from a variety of directions, one being what's the best economic use of the property? What's the mission of the port as it relates to the shipping public in the state, in the Northwest region? What is the reality of the future, not the wishful thinking, but the sort of skeptical thinking about what we might expect from the use as a container. So you've got a big job, but hopefully if you ask the right questions and you solicit the right input, which is a challenging input, you come up with an answer that gives us a plan as we march forward, not a quick fix kind of plan, but a 5 to 10 year plan for using this facility. And you're going to get a lot of, if you already have, a lot of different views, a lot of emotional views as to why this or that's important. But this is our opportunity, really, to define what the right questions are and apply the data to that, and then have a strong recommendation as to what the future should be. And thanks for this. I mean, this is a good start on part of the data that we need, and then you'll be the critical part of what are the right questions.
Great. Thank you.
So, Cindy, we're dealing with budget next.
Thank you. Since we have three presenters, I'm going to just introduce the item from here. Great. Thanks, Jim. Today's discussion of the port's proposed FY17-18 budget is the first of four steps in our annual budget process pursuant to state budget law. This meeting is a public hearing to present the budget message of the proposed budget. The port's budget, developed in conjunction with our strategic and business plans, provides the best estimate of resources and requirements needed to achieve the port's mission. Scott Drum, who's Director of Research and Strategic Analysis, will provide an economic overview, followed by Suzanne Kenny, Director over Budget and Financial Operations, who will present the port's operating budget. Lori Lamoureux, Director of the port's Project Portfolio Office, will describe how we plan for, develop, and manage our capital portfolio, as well as what projects are in the planned portfolio, which is the basis for the port's capital budget for FY17-18. With that, I'll turn it over to Scott, Suzanne, and Laurie.
Thanks.
Thank you, Cindy. I'll start my portion of the presentation with a very big picture look at the economy and then go into a line-by-line review of the outlook for next fiscal year. I had an opportunity to spend some time with University of Oregon economist Tim Dewey to get his thoughts on where the economy might be headed this next fiscal year. Clearly, the state's economy has been doing well. He thinks that will continue. There's nothing immediate out there that he sees as any kind of threat. We have been adding a lot of jobs and adding them very quickly. In fact, Oregon led the nation last year in job growth. Portland was one of the top 10 metro areas in job growth, so the economy has been doing pretty well. At the same time, unemployment rates have been dropping. Both the state and the region have now set historically low unemployment rates. The state around 4.3%, the metro area under 4% at about 3.9%. And Tim suggests that that probably is signaling that this current expansion cycle, which has been going on since 2010, 2011, is likely reaching maturity. And what that means is that over the next year, 18 months, potentially 2 years, what we'll likely see are things like slower job growth. There'll still be growth. It's not negative. It's still positive, just not at the rate that we have been experiencing. He also expects that there will be upward pressure on wages across the economy, not necessarily everywhere and in every sector, but certainly more widespread than we've seen, and certainly not just concentrated in the urban areas of Oregon, but also then starting to spread to rural areas of our state. Another sign that this is reaching maturity is that we'll see likely interest rate increases and a potential uptick in inflation. So as this economy continues to grow and get a little hotter, those are some of the signs that he thinks that we'll see. The outlook for international trade is a little mixed. You know, a strong U.S. dollar typically means that there's a dampened demand for U.S. and Oregon exports. But as I go through the business line outlook, there are some important exceptions to that, which is good news for the port. On the upside, a strong dollar fuels continued demand for imports. It's not just for consumer goods. And Tim and I had a conversation about this because we both think this is something that's often overlooked. A strong economy here also fuels demand for importing intermediate goods, or think about it as components for manufacturing. So that Oregon or other U.S. manufacturers are bringing smaller items, components, and that they then use to make their final product to sell domestically or export abroad. So he thinks that will continue as well. I asked him about risk. You know, things do look good, but what are the threats out there? And he said, really, it's just, there's this great deal of uncertainty from global trade and global economic performance to federal policy, whether it's healthcare, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's foreign relations. There's just a lot of uncertainty. Some of it could be good for the economy, you know, a stimulus. Others will clearly be a drag, but it's just very uncertain right now. That seems to be the view of most economists. Now, turning our attention to our business lines and the outlook for next fiscal year, the marine business line has a mixed outlook. And I should note that while much of the revenue for the marine business line is derived from long-term ground leases with our customers, volume numbers do impact revenue for things such as wharfage and dockage. It's variable in our budget. So it should be a strong year for autos next year. It's been a good year. It will be a good year next year. Hyundai is expecting to increase import volumes across T6. And despite the strong U.S. dollar, Ford is very bullish about exports from Portland to Asia. So that's very good news. And those gains will offset some expected declines from Honda as they move production of the Honda Fit from Japan to Mexico. And this is a switch we've seen back and forth a couple times in the last few years. Toyota volume should remain fairly stable. A tough year for break bulk. This is related to the fact that we're losing barite shipments as a result of a decline in the energy industry. And so as that energy production declines, the need for barite also declines. It's not to say there aren't opportunities for break bulk for us, but there's nothing certain enough yet that we want to talk about in terms of the budget. Mineral bulks also down next year, but this is primarily due to very aggressive price competition in a global potash market. So potash volumes will be down next year. This will be mitigated a little bit by increased soda ash exports as demand for glass worldwide increases, again, due to a growing economy. And then grain up about 10%, and this really reflects a better-than-expected year that grain is having this year. Again, with a strong dollar would signal perhaps not a great year for grain, but a large U.S. harvest and comparatively small storage capacity has meant we have seen a lot more exports than we were expecting here in the Columbia River, and we expect that to continue next year. And of course, as we just heard, next year is a transition year for containers. And across the way over at the terminal, things are looking very good for next year. And these numbers do not reflect any of the service that Bill talked about earlier today. So the numbers are all sort of on the upside here. Passenger growth, nearly 8% next year. As Bill mentioned, a lot of our carriers are adding service to existing markets or starting service to markets they have not previously served from Portland. An additional important component of this is our international seasonal summer air service. So, of course, we have the London launch coming on Delta next month. But also Condor and Iceland Air are expanding their operations here. They're going more deeply into the shoulder season, the spring and the fall, and they're increasing the number of frequencies during the peak summer travel season. So good news there. And then despite all this new service and all the new seats in the market, our load factor is remaining flat, somewhere in the low to mid 80% range. And that's actually a very good sign, because what that means is, as quickly as the carriers are putting new service and new seats into the market's filling them pretty much. So usually when you have this kind of growth, it would be hard to achieve a flat load factor. You might see some loss on that, but we're staying flat, which is a very good sign. The market's responding well, and on that theme, cargo also is going to increase by about 1% on the strength of Cathay Pacific's new service. Their loads have done very well. It's an export service, so again, in the face of a strong U.S. dollar, the loads are doing very well, and we expect them to continue. And there's the possibility they'll increase frequencies during summer perishable season. So it's looking pretty good at the airport. And with all this service, both passenger and cargo, as you would expect, landed weight will increase next year as well. Right now for industrial development, we're projecting about $17 million in sales in what is a very active and hot industrial land market here in Portland. The vacancy rate in industrial facilities is dropping from what were already historically low levels to even more historically low levels. We're now down below 4% vacancy rates, which we just have never seen. As I mentioned earlier, the region's unemployment rate is also at historically low levels, 3.9%, and the value of the goods and services produced in our regional economy grew 6.5% between 2014 and 2015. So there's a lot of economic activity, increased demand for industrial land, and increased strong interest in both Gresham Vista and Trapdale Mills industrial parks. So in addition to these business volumes and activity levels, one of the other key drivers of budget development, as Cindy mentioned, is our strategic plan. And these four areas of focus: regional prosperity, outstanding PDX experience, connecting markets, and organizational effectiveness are all reflected both in the operating budget and the capital budget that Susanna Lori will now present.
Okay, thank you, Scott. So before we start reviewing the operating budget numbers, I wanted to just go over the assumptions that are behind the development of our fiscal year 17-18 budget. As Scott mentioned, we are forecasting a continued growth across most of our business lines. This budget does reflect the lease termination with ICTSI, and as we go through the slides, I'll point out a couple of key areas where you'll see that reflected. As far as our healthcare costs, as you know, the last several years we've been working hard to control the growth of those costs through implementing a pretty robust wellness program that has really taken on here at the port. We've also seen some migration over to the Kaiser plan, but less expensive plan. So overall, we're looking at a growth next year in our healthcare costs of less than 3%. PERS rates, on the other hand, effective July 1 of 2017, will reflect the Morrow decision, which basically undid a lot of the cost savings that the legislative changes had put in place here a couple years ago. What that means for the port is an increase of about $2.8 million annually. That's about a 31% increase in our employer contribution amounts. And just a reminder, PERS sets those employer contribution rates every 2 years, and they are based on the actuarial unfunded liability. And now with the Supreme Court's decision here, which, like I said, undoes most of the cost reductions in PERS, that unfunded liability now has increased, so we're seeing an increase in the rates here to help fund that. I should also point out that short of some other types of PERS reform, we are expecting a similar type increase 2 years from now when the rates are reset. So we are continuing to monitor that, and we are using that in our long-range forecasting plan, again, to manage and prepare for that should that materialize here in a couple more years.
We continue to focus on both asset maintenance and efficiency improvements, and we see that throughout the operating and capital budgets, and really focusing to enhance the region's connection to global and national markets. For PDX, again, you'll see a continuation of focus on the PDX series of projects, really to address the needs here at the airport as a result of all of the passenger growth and airline and cargo growth. This budget does reflect continued industrial land development, and you'll see that as we go through the budget. And certainly, last but not least, our focus continues on cost control and maintaining competitive rates for our customers. So with that, we'll take a look at the operating budget. We'll start with the operating revenues. And the top half of this slide is really the general fund revenues. The first column is our adopted budget for fiscal year 17. The middle column there is our revised budget for the current year, followed by the proposed budget for fiscal year 18. And then the variance columns to the right there are a measure of our proposed budget for 18 compared to our adopted budget for 17. For Marine, there you see the result of the lease termination with ICTSI. That $5 million reduction is really the loss of the annual lease payment from ICTSI. For industrial development there, the reduction of $10 million, that's really a function of the land sales. You can see for fiscal year 17, we had a pretty robust land sale budget of about almost $28 million there. And we are on track, it's the middle here, isolating the land sales. We are on track to meet that here with the anticipated closure of the Amazon deal later this year. And you can see for then fiscal year 18, we're forecasting a little over $17 million in land sales. For navigation, you'll see a reduction here of about $2.5 million. And again, that's really a function of the level of dredging that we get from the Army Corps of Engineers. That is a cost recovery contract that we have with the Corps, so there is a corresponding expense reduction associated with these revenues, lower revenues covering those lower costs. For general aviation, about a $400,000 revenue increase there, primarily out in our Hillsborough Airport, with increased terminal and ground rents out there for GNE. So for the general fund, excluding land sales, there you see a reduction in revenues here of about $6.6 million. Again, most of that being that lease payment from ICTSI. You will see the increase here for the revised budget for 17. That incorporates the $11.5 million lease termination payment from ICTSI. That lease termination payment will help fund some of these costs here over the next 12 to 18 months as we study the terminal and assess what the future of that facility looks like. So for aviation then, we're looking at an increased revenues of about $12.5 million, about 5.5%, with $4 million of that coming from the airlines. And most of that is really driven off of some additional debt service from a recent bond issue that we had earlier this year. There's about $4 million that's now in the rate base associated with that bond issue. There are some operating expense increases for the airlines, but the second line here also includes some offsetting revenues for them. The non-airline revenues, you can see, we're expecting to increase about $8.5 million, and about $3 million of that actually stays in the airline cost and helps lower their terminal rental rates. And most of that is coming from the terminal concessionaires. Chris was here earlier talking about the concession program, and with the additional operators and concepts out there and the additional traffic, we've really seen an uptick in those revenues. So we're looking at about $2.7 million in additional terminal concession revenues for fiscal year 17, or excuse me, fiscal year 18. The other non-airline revenue is made up of increase in parking, rental car, and our TNCs, the Uber and Lyft, the transportation network providers. So overall, total port, excluding land sales, you can see we're looking at an increase of just a little over 2% for fiscal year on revenues. for operating expenses then, at the top you see aviation for forecasting a little over $4 million, about 3.4%. That is really operationally driven. It's an increase associated with some of our outside services contracts. As you recall, we contract out our janitorial services. We also contract out our elevator, escalator. Our parking and roadways are managed by an outside service contract. With the added passengers and activities, we have added costs there, as well as some of our own, a little bit of our own personal services costs. But relative to the increase in passenger growth, we felt that the operating expense growth here seemed in line with the passenger traffic. General aviation there, the increase is primarily driven by the master plan that we'll be undertaking out in Hillsborough next year. For marine, you see an increase of about $500,000, and that is the added cost associated with the port now operating the terminal. There's some utility costs that were previously covered by ICTSI that will now become the port's responsibility. In addition to the consultant that will be helping us work through the evaluation of the facility and some additional costs. Again, the $11.5 million that was part of that lease termination will help cover these costs over the next, like I said, 12 to 18 months as we undertake that study. So navigation, there you see the reduction in costs associated with the reduced activity there. For environmental, reduction of about $4 million compared to the fiscal year 17. You also see for fiscal year 17, our revised forecast is actually down $1 million. That's more a function of the timing and costs that we expect to be incurred here related to our lower Willamette Superfund sites. Much of this has already been accrued. It's just a function of timing and when those activities are expected to occur. So, the bottom line there, you see our support services. These costs are already allocated up above in the operating areas that I just reviewed. But you can see for those groups, we're forecasting a decrease of about 3% for next year, just about $1.5 million. That's really a result of concentrated efforts the last 12 months on the general fund sustainability. These support services groups reside in the general fund, and there's been a lot of focus to on the general fund to help ensure that it's financially stable here going forward. And as a result, then many of these support service groups have been able to reduce costs, primarily through eliminating some positions as they become vacant. And we'll see on the next slide here. Our full-time equivalent positions are down about 1%. For fiscal year 18, down about 7 positions. Again, most of that is general fund related, and most of those positions have been through attrition. There's been no reduction in force that has occurred. These have been as positions have become vacant through retirements or folks leaving the port. We're really focusing on how can we better align the resources that we have to meet the needs that we have here at the organization. So again, navigation, that's a function of the level of dredging activity from Army Corps of Engineers. So total port, including navigation, down a little over 9 positions. And because personal services are such a large component of our operating budget, they represent about half of our operating costs. Wanted to provide a breakdown here of those costs. So at the top, you see our total FTEs down a little over 9 positions, and then the salaries associated with those positions. With the reduction there, you see our total salaries are basically flat with our fiscal year 17 adopted budget. And then we get into the benefits there. That top line there is the PERS employer contribution and the $2.8 million increase that I talked about earlier. For PERS employee, that's really a function of salaries. That's the 6%. That does not change, so that the total dollars will are in line basically with total salaries. And then there you see a little further down the medical as a result of those concentrated efforts on our wellness program. So overall, our total personal services budget for fiscal year 18 is about $3.4 million, 3.3%, with most of that really a result of the PERS rates. And then another view of our total port FTEs, just to kind of put it in perspective of the activity at the airport, because that is such a large portion of the port's business. You can see what's happened here with passenger volume and our FTEs. So we actually are down relative here in 18. We just saw in the earlier slides total port. You did see PDX up a little bit, again, more operationally focused, really meeting the needs of the higher passengers coming through the terminal. So to summarize here for the general fund, excluding navigation, because that is a reimbursement contract and that those expenses and revenues do fluctuate from year to year. We've also chose to exclude general aviation because if there is any shortfall there, either operating or capital, the Port Cost Center on the PDX side will fund that shortfall. And we've also excluded the environmental accruals. So what does this kind of core piece of our general fund look like from an overall profit and loss perspective? You can see the bottom line there, excluding land sales for our current year adopted budget, we're looking at an operating income before depreciation of about $2 million. Incorporating the lease termination payment from ICTSI, we're now looking at about $14.5 million. However, in 18 now, with that lease termination, we are forecasting about a $3.5 million operating loss before depreciation. Did want to quickly point out here the cost of property, you'll notice, is actually going up, and our land sales is actually going down for 18. Again, just the sheer volume of property that's anticipated to be sold. The reason for that is there's more property in fiscal year 18 out in Trip. And with that being a brownfield redevelopment site, the costs out there associated with that industrial park are more expensive than Gresham Vista. So there was more Gresham Vista parcels here in the current year budget. And then finally for PDX, to summarize, how does all of this play out for the airline cost center requirement and their indicators? Up at the top, you see the airline's requirement is going up about $3 million. Because of the added passengers next year and the landed weight, you'll see that both the cost per employment and the landing fee is basically flat with the current year. Revenue sharing, which is revenue that we share with the airlines from the Port Cost Center, it caps out at a coverage ratio of 2x. So it does fluctuate a little bit with the volume of the debt. We've had a little bit more debt come online. So you do see that bumping up about $300,000, but it's basically capped for fiscal year 18 as well as 17. Port Cost Center net income here, we're forecasting increase of over $5 million. Again, that's the parking, rental car, Uber, Lyft, those revenues there that are driving that increase. And then on the bottom, you see the PDX coverage ratios before the revenue sharing and after the revenue sharing continuing to be very healthy at exceeding the 2x coverage. So with that, I will turn the presentation over to Lori, and she'll review the capital.
Good morning. As Scott touched on in his presentation, are tied to our strategic plan. Through our capital improvement program, we prioritize each of our projects on our capital improvement program and tie those priorities directly to our strategic plans. I'm showing you our little graphic of our areas of focus in that bottom right-hand corner. These are how we break out how we prioritize those projects, looking at anywhere from risk management, financial impacts. We even work in our asset performance for our various facilities and asset management related projects. So really what this does is this in one corner of the port at least, really drives and puts our strategic plan into action through work and projects that we are completing on an annual basis. So in terms of our capital planning and capital investment limits, I'll be showing you some graphs and a couple follow-on slides here that will really represent kind of a 15-year history. But we really hone in on a 5-year capital improvement program for both our general fund and our aviation portfolios. I say 5+ because we look at about 10 years worth of projects, but really hone in on that 5 years for planning and funding purposes. I believe Suzanne touched on it, but across our portfolios, many of our projects on our CIP, really over this 15-year period and for a lot of the foreseeable future, are based on facility asset management in terms of rehabilitation, improvements to those facilities, and always looking for efficiencies for our facilities. Our capital investments and limits for our general fund are specific to and based on a pay-as-you-go basis. The limits are drawn on the available cash we have, and you see that in the graph. Versus in aviation, we have 5 major funding sources: cash, grants, PFCs are our passenger facility charges, sorry for the acronym, and our customer facility charges and our debt. We, you're probably well aware, but we, I'll note it again, we work with our airline partners to fund that aviation CIP. So really we have 2 separate CIPs in terms of our funding. Just a little side piece, really from my side of the house, that capital planning, we look at the funding, which I'm representing here, but we look at a lot of our people resources as well. Capital projects are driven by our people resources. And so it's really a balancing act between the people capital that we can provide and the funding. So the couple graphs that I mentioned for you. This is our general fund capital investment. That's showing that 15 years, just to orient you. The green are our closed projects or our closed investments that we've made. The dark blue is our portfolio or our active projects. And for our general fund, rough numbers, we've got about $130 million active portfolio. So active projects we are committing dollars to and spending dollars on. And then those last 4 to 5 years out, that teal color or kind of turquoise color is the future. And we really look at the future for planning purposes, as I noted, as well as funding, what grants we need to get, and such. We're showing up above in those 2 little speech-type bubbles the primary projects that we have active that we've got going on as we speak. You'll see some land development, again, really touching on many of the projects in terms of the asset management and maintaining our asset liabilities. Future projects, dollars for those, again, further out, really for our planning purposes. What I mean by that is the estimates are a little fuzzier the further out you get. We hone those in that 5-year period. But it allows us to take a look at what's coming, what needs to be done, what assets need to be maintained, what efficiencies need to be gained for our facilities. So for those future projects, you can see across the board, we've got airfield work, some pavement work, whether it's roads, we've got navigation, work in our marine facilities, and always land development. Going over to PDX, our airline, a slightly different looking graph for you. Again, same closed active portfolio and then future pipeline. We've got about a total of, I think it's about $1.5 billion in our active portfolio. And that's really capturing, as you can see in our primary capital projects, that's really capturing the extension of Concourse E, starting to look at the terminal core work that we've been taking on, pending airline approvals. It's big expenditure at PDX in things like loading bridges. This really is focusing in on that asset maintenance, but things that are critical to our operation here, and always taking on pavement improvements, whether it's driving pavement or airfield type of pavement. And again, future looking out there, you'll see a lot of that dark blue, and that's a lot of those commitments towards the Terminal E, or the Concourse E, I'm sorry, the Terminal Core, as well as maintaining our operation for PDX. That's it.
Uh,
Okay. The final slide just summarizes the public process. As Cindy mentioned, today is the first meeting on the port's fiscal 17-18 budget. We'll be back in May requesting your approval to submit the budget to the Tax Supervising Conservation Commission for their review. They will then hold their public hearing on our budget on June 14th, following the regular commission meeting. And then on June 22nd, we'll have a special commission meeting to adopt the port's budget for fiscal year 18. And that'll, that's traditionally the relatively short call meeting.
Any questions or comments? It's a lot of work. A lot of money.
A lot of money.
Yeah. Questions, comments? I need to open this as a public hearing. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to comment on the proposed budget? I'll close that public hearing, and we don't have any action required currently, so we will see you again in May.
Thank you very much.
We've got three consent items now. Does anyone want a presentation on any of the three consent items? Okay.
Could I just, on one, I just want to point out that one of the assistant treasurers who you're about to appoint is something about in favor of this is a brand new employee of ours, Ed McDonald, who's right here. He's our new risk manager and came to us from the Cleveland Airport. So just wanted
great.
To make
welcome.
Sure you had a chance to.
I saw there was a slew of names as assistants. There.
Yeah.
Even you're on there.
Oh, I'm an assistant to everything.
Okay. Well, congratulations. Welcome to him. Were we missing somebody, Tom?
Yes, I don't mind. We also have a flight employee injury, Wendy Starr, coming back to us. It was 2 years ago. That's right.
Okay, well, welcome back. And congratulations to both of you. I don't know how much that'll require the assistant treasurer job, but. So I'll read the titles. First is Port of Portland Fire Department Civil Service Commission appointment. The PDX. The second is appointment and designation of assistant treasurers. And the third is service contract, waste hauling, recycling services, and medical waste disposal for Portland facilities. We need a motion and second for the approval of those three items.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Pat, are you still with us?
Okay. I am, and I'm in favor.
Okay. Any opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Thank you. And Stan, now you've got a procurement contract we're going to talk about.
Wow. In our navigation division, we use multiple cranes to support our material handling requirements. And three of our existing cranes are beyond their useful life and need to be replaced. And the most efficient thing that we've determined is to replace them with only two new cranes. So a little bit of efficiency there. And Tom Peterson, our Director of Engineering, is here to present the agenda item to get approval to procure these cranes. So,
good morning.
Good color photos, Tom, in the
you like
materials.
Them?
Yeah.
Actually, I'm covering for Chet Thomas, who's he's responsible for the agenda. I'm the standby, I guess. So this morning I'm here to request your approval to award a contract to North American Lifting Equipment in the amount of about $612,000 to purchase two hydraulic marine cranes for the Dredge Oregon. There we go. So the cranes in particular are the old overhead bridge crane that's on the bow of the dredge. No longer suitable, doesn't meet current safety requirements. So we're going to be replacing that crane with the crane that you see on the right. Additionally, in the bow, we have two old cranes that are beyond their useful life that we use for moving materials on and off the dredge. We're going to replace it with this crane that you see on the right that has a much longer lifting span, so we don't really need the two cranes any longer. The budget for this project is about $1.2 million. The cranes are worth, as I mentioned, $612,000 approximately. We will be installing the cranes with our dredge crew. So the contracted services is primarily related to the crew installing the cranes. There are some additional materials that we'll need to consider part of this project as well. This project is funded through our contract with the Army Corps of Engineers. Upon your approval, we will commence with the fabrication delivery. We expect the cranes to be delivered sometime in November, which will allow the crew then to do the installation in preparation for the next dredging season. With that, staff recommends approval of the executive director's recommendation.
Any questions or comments? Motion and second?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks. Curtis.
Walk on. Good morning, commissioners. I'm here this morning on behalf of Keith Levitt, who had to duck out. You saw him earlier, but he's off to Salem this morning. As you know, since 2008 at the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park, we've been upgrading and improving the site to essentially create a national leading brownfield redevelopment site. Transactions like the one that hopefully you'll approve lead us into activities that take us to, as an example, the February approval this year of the 74 acres to Troutdale Associates LLC, the project which cannot be called the Amazon project. Grading of lots 4 and 5 will bring another 22.5 acres to shovel-ready status. Robin McCaffrey is here to present a request for approval to award a construction contract to Rough Grade lots 4 and 5.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So as Curtis said, this item is to request approval to award a public improvement contract, in this case to Westech Construction, for the lots 4 and 5 grading project for just over $1 million. This is probably a familiar view for you all at this point. It's been updated to show pending sales options and the purchase of lot 1 from FedEx Ground. You can see relative to the other trip development where lots 4 and 5 come in on the right. The utilities for 4 and 5 have already been placed, and this is really just to finish the grading on the project. This is a view of the property. If you haven't been out there lately, it's hard to see. Where's my cursor? I have no cursor, but on the front of lots 4 and 5, closest to Swigert Way, there's about a 20-foot mound of material. The project essentially moves that mound and spreads it out on the site to allow for a gravity flow of sanitary utilities for the building that will eventually be put, we believe and hope, on lot 4 in the back. The schedule is as shown here. Design is completed. We are at the diamond, and with your approval, construction would begin with a substantial completion in September and finishing out in October. Shown here is the budget. The contract in question is the top line. You can see port staff and services. This was designed in-house. The contingency is roughly 10%, and the source is the general fund. With that, staff requests approval of the executive director's recommendation.
It seems like a lot of money to move a little gravel, but there must be something more to it.
Well, it's we could put you to work
lot.
Out there.
Like. I'm doing my own shoveling lately.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about 100,000 plus cubic yards of material. It's it's a lot of money.
Any meaningful questions or comments?
Well,
is there a motion and second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Pat?
I'm in favor.
Okay.
And I do have to log off.
Okay, no, we're done. So.